You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Welcome to MLB.com Extras American League Central. I'm Matt Wehmeyer. We kick things off this week with Royals reporter Jeffrey Flanagan, and much to the chagrin of Royals fans, the main topic of discussion should come as no surprise. Here we go again, just like last week, Jeffrey, another installment of What's Wrong with Johnny Cueto. A Sunday night, 6 1/3, 11 hits, 7 earned runs, and 4 homers given up. Another ugly outing, any way you slice it. Now, last week we said that there was definitely concern about Cueto, but things were not quite at crisis level. But what about now?
I think we've gone to DEFCON 4 here. I think it's there's concern because they just don't know what the issue is. They thought it might be a little bit of lack of confidence, but he claims that's not it. There's concerns that maybe there's an injury, but he's checked out with the trainers. Ned was talking yesterday that if there was some concern about that, that part of the body would be weak, and you could decipher an injury that way. But he checks out strong in all the body parts, all the arms, elbows, shoulders. So there's really no reason to go get an MRI. He says he feels 100%, and you got to believe him on that. It's just kind of brutal watching him out there. It's basically batting practice for the other team, and these are not cheap shots. These were just rockets going all over the field, and I think the only thing that Ned and his staff could come up with last night is that they really like to see him to get back to establishing his fastball command and really work off that pitch. He's been getting beat a lot on his secondary stuff, his changeup and his cutter. And Adam Jones did hit a fastball homer last night, but mostly it's been, a lot of breaking stuff that's getting rocked, and he's kind of leaving over the middle of the plate. So his fastball, actually his two-seam fastball, looks pretty good. And I think maybe in the next start you might see that where he will just kind of pound the zone with fastball and just see if that can get him out of this slump.
And, Jeffrey, there was an odd story last week, middle of the week, I believe, where Johnny Cueto kind of no-showed an autograph session, I believe. Is this a big deal? Did that kind of blow over? Did that have an adverse effect on all the other struggles that he's having on the field? What's your take on that whole thing?
Well, I don't know all the stuff firsthand. I haven't spoken to him about it. But I guess he had set up this kind of meet and greet thing. It was not an autograph session. It was just a tiny meet and greet thing through a local radio station. And from what I understand, actually, it was his kind of agent kind of set it up to, kind of get to know the Kansas City fans and stuff like that. And lo and behold, he just no shows and said he was getting treatment for his hand, and we don't have any record of a hand injury or anything like that. So it was a little ugly. It was probably, from what I was told, I talked to some of the guys that were there, some of the radio guys that were there. The people that were actually in attendance were not that troubled by it. It became more of a Twitter issue than anything else. The people that weren't there were complaining more than the people that were there. The people that were, I guess, they got treated to a bunch of stuff and had a good time for your 90 minutes or whatever. And now I know that the restaurant that it was held at, they were very upset, of course, and I think they fired off a pretty nasty Facebook editorial. But I don't know. I mean, are the two things connected, with him and with his struggles and his confidence? I have no idea. It's just right now, Johnny Cueto went from, savior in Kansas City to, hey, should we even have him on the playoff roster? Which is kind of bizarre that all that could happen in a matter of three weeks.
Yeah, it really is, considering how spectacular his home debut went, pitching the shutout, I believe. And then to go from that to this, and like you said, the story, it was a bigger deal to those who weren't there than to those who were there. But I think just given the timing of it, with his struggles on the field, it just could not have been. It could not have taken place at a worse time, I think.
No, that's very true, and you got to go back to, like you mentioned, the home debut. And I look back at those four games, his first four games with the Royals, he was absolutely outstanding. I mean, he was everything they bought into and gave up three prospects for. I mean, one game was a complete game shutout. There's another 8-inning game where he gave up, I think, 4 hits and 1 run. The other two games were quality starts. One was at Toronto, trying to calm those hammer throwers down in Toronto, and he actually did it for 6 innings. And so, I mean, this thing just snapped overnight where he had one bad outing and boom, he hasn't been the same since. So they've got to get it figured out. I mean, it's, we're still less than 3 weeks away from the end of the regular season. He's probably going to get maybe 3, maybe 4 more starts before October. And this has got to get fixed. This has got to get solved because they were counting on him to be the number one starter in October.
Yeah, it's such a stunning development with Johnny Cueto these last couple of weeks, no question. Jeffrey, I want to get your take on a very interesting tweet that I saw from our friends at the Elias Sports Bureau. They said, and this really knocked me out of my chair when I saw it, Johnny Cueto is the only pitcher in Major League history whose career, and I'm sure you know where I'm going with this, his career ERA has increased every month of the regular season between April and September. So kind of a two-part question. Were the Royals aware of this when they made this trade? And if so, how much do you think it concerned them, if any?
Probably didn't concern them at all, because they're not, you know, they're not a slave to numbers. You know, they were basically, did he pitch deep into the games? Is he helping his team win? Does he have an ace mentality? And, you know, yes, to all those kind of questions. So, you know, the numbers are kind of, it did strike me as kind of odd, too. But, you know, this is a three-month rental. You know, it's not a guy they're signing to a 10-year deal or anything like that. They just want to be able to get him, you know, well and into October with his confidence level high, and they're trying to go out and win a world championship with him.
And, Jeffrey, I want to get your take, too, on the kind of role that pitching coach Dave Island can play right now. The relationship between he and Johnny Cueto is still kind of in its infancy, but is Dave Island in a spot where he can maybe implement some of his own philosophies and teachings that may or may not jibe with what he learned from his many years with the Reds?
Maybe. I mean, I think one thing Dave is very careful about is not to overwhelm guys with a bunch of, you know, Giants are being flooded with suggestions probably right now from every direction. And it's like a hitter in a slump. You know, all of a sudden you get 10 guys, plus your family, plus your friends are telling, hey, do this, do that. And Dave doesn't want to just flood him and get his brain all messed up with, you know, a bunch of crazy ideas. They're trying to strip it down and go back to the fundamentals. What, they look at the tape, what does he do well? What has he done well in the past to be successful? And I get back to, I think, just relying on that two-seam fastball, which is a very good, very, very good pitch. And I think you're going to see that more and more. Dave's an excellent pitching coach. Mechanically, they don't see any issue with him. Obviously, health-wise, they don't see anything. I think it's just probably his approach to hitters right now is he's pitching kind of backwards. He's too much heavy on the cutter and the off-speed stuff and not enough with his live fastball. So I think that's their last resort. And then you just kind of hope that a veteran like Johnny Cueto can work it out. You know, we talked to him last night and asked him if he should maybe skip a start and kind of, you know, reset the computers to a degree, rebooted, and he said, no, I'm Johnny Cueto. I need to go out and pitch every 5 days. So that was a pretty confident thing to say after, you know, this horrible five-game stretch.
And I think it's safe to say that Chris Sale is not going to be sending greeting cards to anyone on the Twins during the holidays. Sale ties her career low on Sunday, a three-inning start, and two of those three-inning starts have come against the Twins this season. Can anybody in that Minnesota clubhouse begin to explain the team's staggering success against one of the game's truly dominant pitchers?
That really is amazing. I think his ERA this year against the Twins is above six. I think he's 1-4 in the six starts against the Twins. They pretty much beat up on him every start now the last, you know, four or five times. The Twins really haven't found a way to explain it, maybe because they know something they don't really want to give away. There's just maybe a chance that they're seeing something, maybe they're tipping his pitches. That could be kind of something they're seeing from him, but it really is hard to explain. I mean, this guy's one of the best pitchers in baseball. You know, he'll get a strikeout sometimes against the Twins, but you know, they kind of jump on his fastball, you know, 2,000 hit the big home run there in the first inning. Yeah, it's been hard to explain, but definitely a big reason for their success this year. I think the Twins went, 13-9 against the White, 13-6 against the White Sox. That's a big reason for why they're still in it right now.
What about on the flip side of things, Rhett? Has Sale himself had any sort of explanation why he struggles so mightily against the Twins?
Not really. I think he's more anything. He's just really frustrated. You really can't figure it out. I think just kind of his starts right now, he kind of just gets bugged by these Twins. I think in the past, it was just kind of those big rallies that kind of string together some hits. I said yesterday was more of a big three-run home run early. But still, I mean, yeah, I don't think he's really figured out a way to explain it yet. I think if he could, he'd probably try to find a way to change it and to fix it. But I'm definitely very curious to see how it goes next year, see if he can make adjustments. Because, you know, I figure he's probably going to be in that rotation again unless the White Sox decide to trade him. But, you know, going forward, to see if the Twins can keep us up, because he has been so dominant throughout his career. And just such a strange thing, because last year, really, the Twins didn't really beat up on him much. And all of a sudden, this year, it's really been one of those things where every time they face him, they've had good numbers against him.
Yeah, one of those really mysterious things about the Twins, of course, are not complaining. You made reference to that three-run homer that came off the bat of Torrey Hunter on Sunday. Torrey drives in four. He's now batting 314 in September after badly slumping in July and August, something that we addressed last week. Is he kind of forcing Paul Molitor's hand right now a little bit in terms of earning playing time over some of the younger guys like Buxton and Hicks and Rosario, to name a few?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, right now he's really playing pretty well. Obviously, that was July and August. You know, numbers are very bad. It's kind of getting mixed in here and there to keep him fresh. That kind of plan at least works in the sense that this September he's been very good. You know, the 300 home run was his first home run in more than a month, but a very big one. And he's really been hitting the ball really well all month. So it's one of those things where we'll kind of see how he gets mixed in. I got to figure that the Twins like their defensive output right now, and they can throw Buxton in the center and throw in Rosario and Hicks. It's kind of a nice little combination of just speed and good arms in the outfield. But I do think with the way that Hunter's hitting right now, especially against, you know, left-handers and guys, you know, where he can kind of drive the ball, he's going to get mixed in there and play some right field and maybe even DH in some days where they want to give Snell a rest with his hamstring. So, yeah, I think he's kind of forcing the hand. The good thing is, you know, if he continued to slump, they might have had to kind of just back off him almost the rest of the month and kind of play him really sparingly and kind of just mixing those young guys. But right now, with his bat being as potent as it's been, yeah, you got to figure that he's going to get more playing time here down the stretch, and especially, like I said, against left-handers and guys like that.
And, Rhett, how invaluable is it for the Twins to have a guy like Torrey Hunter who can impart his knowledge and his experience on guys who are still very wet behind the ears, all the talent in the world, but not the experience yet, like Buxton and Miguel Sano?
Yeah, definitely. Even if you look at guys like Brian Dozier and Trevor Plouffe, guys that have been around for a little while, they've never been in a postseason race like this before. The Twins haven't really been competitive in September since 2010. Really only a couple of guys have been around, you know, I think Dunsing and Perkins and Maurer were probably the only three guys on that team that were even around the last time the Twins were competitive. So, yeah, to have, you know, a guy like Hunter who's been there and done that, has been in the postseason plenty with the Twins, you know, Angels and Tigers, to have them kind of be a leader. And Molitor, too, is a guy that, you know, has been around there, you know, a long Hall of Fame career and kind of keeps these guys loose. It really hasn't been an issue so far. Every time they've had a little bit of a setback, whether it was getting swept in New York, and they bounced right back from it. I mean, the start of the year when they were 1-6, they bounced right back. So every time you think the Twins are dead, they keep finding ways to kind of come alive and have big series, especially on the road. You know, another winning road trip against some tough teams there. So, just having Hunter around to kind of help these guys around is definitely helpful. But we saw last year, too, a team like the Royals that was full of a lot of young guys and a lot of guys who hadn't been there, you know, got all the way to the World Series. You never know how much experience really does help, but it does help to at least have a guy in the room that's been through a lot of that and can kind of, you know, talk to these guys and calm them down for some of these bigger games and explain to them kind of how it goes during the, you know, postseason race like this.
And, Rhett, I certainly don't want to overlook the effort on Sunday of Kyle Gibson. He was fantastic. All the talk about, you know, Torrey Hunter and Chris Sale, deservedly so, but you cannot forget about Gibson. 7-2/3 scoreless. He is now 4-0 against the White Sox in his career. ERA of 2.13. And in three September starts, he has an ERA under 3. Is this the most consistent stretch you've seen from him this season?
I think he might have been a little bit more consistent early in the year. That first half, he was very good. I think he ended the first half with an ERA below 3 and had a nice little stretch there going into the second half. One back-to-back starts going into the break that last week there, giving the Twins a 6-1 record going into the All-Star break. But right now, yeah, this last three, it's definitely important for him to kind of get back on track. He did kind of fall off there a little bit in late July and August after such a strong start. And you never kind of wondered if he was tiring maybe or kind of, you know, all the innings were kind of starting to add up a little bit over the last couple of years. Better young guy, you know, only a couple of years removed from Tommy John and all that, but he's been stronger recently. And then, you know, his previous start before, his good start there on Sunday in Kansas City, you know, gets blasted for 4 runs on the first 9 pitches of the game, but then ends up settling in and getting his first complete game. So he's been kind of showing that he can bounce back from kind of some of the adversity, which last year was kind of his biggest issue. I think his ERA in losses was, you know, astronomical. I want to say it was like above 11 or 12. So he's one of those guys last year was either really on his game or really off his game. And I think this year he's found ways, even when he doesn't have his best stuff, to get through it. And I think the good news for the Twins right now is it seems like his good stuff is back, especially these last three starts here.
The Indians split a twin bill with the Tigers yesterday and now stand 70-71, 4.5 games back of that second wild card. Jordan, in a strange way, do you almost wish the Indians did not have to play that second game yesterday, considering how hard it is to sweep doubleheaders and that they could have entered Monday with that .500 record that they were chasing for so many weeks?
Well, I tell you what, after sitting through 2 rainouts, I think they were thrilled to be playing baseball. They reached .500, you know, between games. We got to talk a little bit about that with Terry Francona and Cody Anderson, the pitcher, briefly before they were starting up game 2. And, you know, that kind of has been sort of this this point that they just haven't been able to get to. You know, they'd get within three of 500 and go on a losing streak, and then they were getting up to two and getting within one, and it was like, it was nice to see, you know, them finally kind of get that monkey off their back, reach 500, even though it was for a half hour. You know, so I think that is something that kind of could be a little bit of a sense of relief for the team, you know, and going forward here, they can kind of continue to play the brand of baseball they've been playing since June, which is strong pitching, dramatically improved defense, and that's been a combination that has really helped this team go from what we thought was going to be purely an evaluation period for the final 2 months of the season to a team that is, you know, forcing people to talk about them in the wild card race. So it's going to be an interesting final few weeks here, and I think we're a little surprised that the Indians are in this thing as much as they are right now.
And Jordan, you brought up a good point that everybody, fans included, thrilled to play two games on Sunday, given the wet weekend we had prior to that, rainouts on both Friday and Saturday. What is the plan with the rainout Saturday, considering that there are very few off days remaining between now and the end of the regular season?
Right. The Indians only have one off day coming up for the rest of the way, and the Tigers, I believe they have three, but the Indians are playing on all three of those days. The Tigers also have another doubleheader on their schedule coming up next week, I believe. You know, so it's just kind of a complicated situation. Detroit doesn't come back. Cleveland doesn't go there. It's a situation where it could wind up being one of those games tacked on after October 4th as an if-necessary game. If the Indians continue to claw their way back into the wild card race, you know, maybe that's a situation where it needs to be played. They tack it on to that last game, that day off for baseball, you know, and squeeze it in there. Otherwise, I mean, really the only other alternative would be for the Indians to have a doubleheader with two opponents where they would play the Tigers maybe in an early game and then have their regularly scheduled home game against another team that's in town. That scenario hasn't really been discussed yet, at least publicly. So I think right now we're kind of in a holding pattern in terms of when they could make this game up.
Yeah, definitely a wait-and-see situation on that for sure. Jordan, rough outing in Game 2 on Sunday for Trevor Bauer. He continues to go from one extreme to the other in his last half dozen starts. A lot of Jekyll and Hyde going on there. Just three innings on Sunday in Game 2, giving up six runs. Is there something you can kind of pinpoint, either in terms of mechanics or approach or maybe a little of both, that goes awry for Trevor Bauer when he struggles this poorly?
Well, I mean, if you're looking at Game 2 in a vacuum, one thing Terry Francona was quick to bring up was just the really unusual circumstances that were thrown into it. And we even saw Randy Wolf, the Tigers pitcher, although he's not having a great year and his numbers aren't that great. I mean, he really struggled and only went three innings as well. But, you know, you had the doubleheader, you had the two rainouts pushing back guys' schedules by 48 hours. Then you had Bauer, who has a pretty regimented preparation for his starts routine. You know, that's kind of thrown off when you're in a traditional doubleheader and you only have a half hour in between games. You know, and then he had a couple of things happen within the game where a bloop single, a little dribble around the infield, and next thing you know, that turns into a big inning for the Tigers. So there were some sort of circumstances on Sunday that were going against him right out of the chute. That said, as you mentioned, you know, you look at his last seven starts, he's gone four innings or fewer in four of them. I believe his ERA is over seven in that span, and he's kind of been alternating quality starts with just really awful starts. And he said that's been the most frustrating thing for him right now, is that that it's not like a middle ground. But when it's going bad, I mean, he's not even giving his team a chance to win. And right now, wins are, you know, at a premium for this team as they're trying to claw back into this race. So he's feeling the pressure there, and the Indians have got to be feeling the pressure of, you know, can we continue to throw this guy out there every 5 days when he's struggling like he is? They've been working with him a little bit on trying to work lower in the strike zone. The guy who really prides himself on pitching higher in the strike zone and elevating, they're hoping that he can maybe work down first and then elevate by design. That's something they've been working with him on over the last few weeks. Obviously, there's been some turbulent and, as you mentioned, Jekyll and Hyde type results from him over the last month, 2 months.
And by now, we're pretty much all aware Last week, a Detroit TV station citing unnamed sources and saying that Brad Ausmus will be fired at the end of the 2015 season, and the Tigers, for their part, denying everything. I've always been a kind of a big believer in where there's smoke, there's fire, so I guess what's your take on this whole situation?
Well, there's been smoke building for a while regarding that situation. I know you kind of have to balance out the roster that Ausmus has to manage against the job that Ausmus has done managing it. But when you combine the Dave Dombrowski firing in August, you know, the guy who hired Ausmus, with, you know, the right of any new general manager to pick his own guy, with the way this team seems to be trending down the stretch, and right now every sign points towards a separation, and really it might end up being best for both sides at this point. You know, I don't think Ausmus would be unemployed for long. I think he would get a job with another club, maybe in a better situation, at least for his style, and maybe with a little bit less baggage. And the Tigers would have a chance to go in a new direction, maybe one that would better suit ownership and better suit everybody involved.
In your dealings with Brad Ausmus, is he starting to wear the stress of this situation a little bit here in the season's final weeks, or has he kept kind of an even keel and doing his best to kind of dismiss everything?
I think he's shown signs of stress. I don't think he's shown outright panic. You get the sense that, and maybe more than the sense, I think he said, he had a pretty telling quote, I thought, after the after reports came out. Later on that the next day, he said, "I'm comfortable with the situation we have." And to me, I took that as, you know, he knows where the signs are pointing. He understands what his fate's probably going to be in a few weeks, and he's okay with it. He's okay managing out the season and, you know, moving on and figuring out which way to go from there. I think he knows that a good part of this season isn't going to fall on him, at least in regards to how teams around baseball and potential employers around baseball look at his situation. I think you look at a roster that has proven disappointing and difficult to manage, especially from a bullpen standpoint. And I think that he's going to be willing to live with what this means on his resume.
And, Jason, I found it interesting that Justin Verlander last week, you know, he kind of drew a line in the sand between the media and the team when the subject of Ausmus was brought up to him last week. He pretty much said, you know what, everything you guys do, it's white noise to us. It does not come into the clubhouse doors. Is that a sign to you, perhaps, that despite all the struggles and all the adversity and the stress, that Brad Ausmus is still held in pretty high regard by the key veterans on this team, including Verlander?
Well, I mean, there were different quotes from different players coming out of there, you know, especially that day. Ian Kinsler, I think, said a lot. You know, I think he kind of put a lot of weight on the team being at fault for this season, but I think also he kind of minimized the impact that Ausmus has had on the fate of this team. I don't know if it was a rousing defense of Brad, but I think it was kind of an acknowledgement that things have gone wrong in so many ways with this team that Brad and the players are basically in the same boat. And there's probably going to be a lot of shared responsibility to go along when the season's over.
So, Jason, if things do play out the way that we're speculating they will, and that Brad Ausmus will not be back with this team in 2016, that kind of begs the question, in what direction do the Tigers turn? Do they try to look for another Brad Ausmus type, a guy that had a long, distinguished playing career? Do they go with a Jim Leland type? I mean, where do you think they go here as they – again, if we think they're going to dismiss Brad Ausmus, what do you think the next step is?
Well, the signs right now are pointing towards kind of turning in the other direction and going towards an experienced manager. And if this team still has a win-now emphasis, which is what every statement from ownership, and not that we've had a whole ton of statements coming out of ownership recently, unfortunately, but everything that's been said in recent weeks has suggested that win now remains the goal and that they're going to try to reload and try for another run next year. Well, I think if you're looking that way, then you're going to have to, or it makes most sense, go towards a veteran manager, somebody who's managed in the big leagues before. And really, when you look at some of the other managerial situations around baseball, I think that you're going to see reversal of the trend. And I think the veteran managers are going to get a good look from a few different teams here. There's been a lot of talk about Ron Gardenhier. I know Mike Ilitch has talked highly of the model that the Twins set years ago, back when they were basically owned the American League Central. I think he had a high amount of respect for that team and for what Ron Gardenhier did with it. And so I think if Gardenhier finds the situation appealing, I think there could be a match there. I think Rick Renteria is another guy to watch out for. He managed in the Florida Marlins farm system back when Al Avila was there. He did, I thought, a better than advertised job managing the Cubs. And he's got an ability to communicate well with players from a lot of different backgrounds. You hear some other guys getting some buzz, but I think those are the main two names. We'll probably see some other guys emerge, and maybe we haven't heard a whole ton about. Some people have speculated about Manny Acta. He might get an interview, although I don't know if he really fits what the Tigers are necessarily looking for. But he might be somebody who gets a look. And depending on what happens here near season's end, you might see some other names emerge. I always thought Torey Lovullo was a guy who could be a good fit, not just because of his Tigers background, but because of all the work he put in managing the minor leagues. Well, depending on what happens with the Red Sox situation, that could be another direction to look. So there's not going to be, it's not going to be short on options, but at the same time, I don't know how long you're going to drag this out or if they're going to try to fill something up pretty quickly after the season's over.
And we've used the term consistently inconsistent all season to describe this White Sox team. And I hate to single out Chris Sale because he's been so good all year, but he was hung with two of the team's four losses on the six-game homestand at a time when they really needed him to step up and be the ace he's always been. That did not quite pan out this last week or so.
Yeah, it's kind of strange. They've lost four straight at the time of the statement. They've lost four straight starts from Sale. Now, of course, one of those starts they lost to Boston 2-0 when both Chris Sale and Rick Porcello threw seven scoreless innings, and I think Sale struck out 10 and gave two hits. So obviously it's not all. As we all know, wins and losses are a little overrated in terms of starting pitching. But the biggest thing is, it's been a weird season for him against the Twins. The Twins have just had his number. It's, 1-4 record with a 7.36 ERA over six starts. I looked it up. The only other time in his career that he's had something like that, he was 0-4 a couple years ago and four starts against the Indians. The year the Indians beat the Sox almost every game, I think they were 17-2 they finished up, and that was mainly the reason they got into the playoffs. They got the wild card. He was 0-4 with like an 8 ERA that year. So otherwise, when you're playing these teams as many times as they do, you're going to get four or five matchups for some starters against the Twins or against the Tigers or against the Royals or against the Indians. And Chris has been, obviously one of the best pitchers in baseball. And for some reason this year, after being pretty successful against the Twins overall, it just has not happened. And they've hit him hard. It's not just a couple, huge shots falling in. I will say a couple runs he gave up later in the game came after Enemy slipped on a Miguel Sano line drive to center, but still the first four in the first inning were all hard hit balls. And Tyler Flowers said that, the catcher of the White Sox said they've looked at tape to see if he's tipping anything, but Torrey Hunter kind of laughed and said, no, it's just kind of a mental state right now that they, feel like they can hit him, and it very well may change next year when they face him. But, Chris has struggled against the Twins this year.
It's just such an odd thing because his track record speaks for itself, but again, against the Minnesota Twins, he just can never seem to find himself. In talking to Chris Sale, does he or does any athlete ever admit that, this particular team or this particular player is in my head a little bit, and they kind of psych themselves out when they know they're going up against a team that they've struggled with in the past? Is that the case at all with Sale, or is it something else?
I think some athletes will say that, but Chris is not like that. Chris is
so good at what he does. And, you know, like I said before, he reminds me of Mark Burley with better stuff. And I think Mark would be the first one to agree with that comment, and Chris would be the second one. In that he's just, you know, very quick worker, very laid back. He trusts Tyler Flowers and Don Cooper and Robin and, you know, the game plan they put together and just follows it. And, you know, I don't think, maybe after the season he'll say that it got a little bit, you know, in his head, but I don't think that's the case. I just think it's been a rough spot from there. And the sad thing for Chris, I think, is that, you know, his numbers are so overwhelming. He's got 250 strikeouts this year. I believe it's just the fifth time in White Sox history and the first time in like 100 years that a pitcher has struck out 250. The first four belong to Ed Walsh, by the way, who was way back when set all these records. And Chris has got the next two. But, you know, I think probably this rough stretch against the Twins is going to end up costing him Cy Young support. You know, his ERA is now up in the 3.5, 3.6 areas, where if you compare it to other worthy candidates like Dallas Keuchel and Sonny Gray, who the Sox are, you know, facing tonight with Oakland, or tonight, you know, Monday night against Oakland, you know, it kind of falls a little bit. So, yeah, this little bit of a slump, this unexplainable slump against the Twins. I mean, it is explained that the Twins are a good team, and they, you know, like many other teams, they try to jump on Chris early because they don't want to get that slider or change up late in the count and strike out. But it's just been, every time he's been out there this year, except the first start, it's just been all Twins.
Yeah, it's and really stunning. Again, you know, like we said, he's had three starts in his career of three innings. Two of those have come against the Twins this season. The third start of three innings was a rain delay. So that really, you kind of throw that one out. He just didn't come out for the fourth inning after a lengthy delay. So it was two shortest starts of his career, both this season against the Minnesota Twins. Something really stunning indeed. On the other side of the coin, Sale's abbreviated outing on Sunday did mean some extended time on the mound for Frankie Montas, the very highly touted prospect. Kind of a mixed bag for him. Three walks, four hits, and three innings, but gave up just the one run, and he did strike out five. Just kind of give us your observations of his performance overall on Sunday in relief of Sale.
You know, very good effort. He pitched out of two bases loaded jams. Now, like you said, as you pointed out, the caveat to that is he created the bases loaded jams. You know, the second one, he walked a couple guys. Well, he's got overpowering stuff, and you know, I was talking to the White Sox pitching coach, Don Cooper, on Sunday, and he basically said with his command already of the fastball and the slider, assuming he continues to them for strikes. You know, he already is kind of said he could be a major league reliever and probably an elite one, you know, near the end of the game because he does. He has it 100 miles an hour this year and he consistently is in the 97 to 99 range there. So, yeah, I think it's good for him. I really think you're going to see him get some sort of start, maybe like an abbreviated start, maybe a bullpen type day in Detroit. You know, they have four games coming. They have 11 game road trip coming up before the last six games at home after these four in Chicago against Oakland. And the four against Detroit is a doubleheader on that Monday with a makeup game from a rainout earlier this season, and then Tuesday and Wednesday games followed by four in New York, which is all preceded by three in Cleveland. So I think, you know, you'll see the regular starters go in Cleveland. I think you'll see a little rearrangement in that Detroit series. And one of the games could be Montas, you know, getting a three or four inning start, kind of like what they did with Hector Noesi a couple years ago when they first brought him in and built him in. But yeah, I think they're rightfully so very high in that. That's a trade to look back on. And granted, things didn't go exactly or not even close to exactly what the White Sox wanted this year, but that trade that sent JT to Boston and Iglesias to Detroit and Avisaio Garcia and Frankie Montas and a couple other prospects, Cleolis Rondon and J.B. Wendelken to the Sox, it turned out to be a pretty good deal, you know, overall. I mean, JT won a World Series, Iglesias is the Tiger shortstop. You know, Garcia's had a decent year for his first full year, and Montas could be the steal of that trade and really, you know, really help them out, if not as a starter, as some sort of late inning bridge guy.
Thank you for tuning in to this installment of MLB.com Extras American League Central, and be sure to join us again next week.